Introduce on this Monday morning, the 28th of August, our business futurist, Morris Mislowski. He has his eye on the future and his mouth with us. Very good morning to you, Morris.
And a good morning to you too, Keir.
We are talking mouth stuff here this morning because we're going to have a bit of a focus on the future of food. Because as you can imagine, we're going to see some pretty impressive population growth around the planet over the next, you know, few decades or so. So the question remains, how are we going to feed people? To set the scene first, Morris, can you give us a sense of what that growth is going to look like and what we're needing to do to you know, measure up as far as food production is concerned?
Well, it's the largest growth of humanity we have ever seen on the planet. We currently sit at about 7.4 billion globally, and even the mildest of predictions say that we're going up to just over 10 billion by the time we get to 2030. In Australia, we're sitting somewhere at about 24.5 million right now, and again, the mildest of predictions talks about us getting very close to 40 million by the time we get to 2050. In amongst that here as well is this notion that we also now have the largest sector of middle class rising, and we believe that there will be about 60% of the world's population in what we roughly now term middle class, which means that their food sustenance has increased, their calorie intake has increased, their desire for alternate foods has increased.
So just the variety of foods alone, yeah. Morris, and what they're going to be satisfied by is very different from, you know, a different sort of subsistence kind of food.
And that's exactly it. So it really is all of these things that are colliding together to say that literally over the next 30 years, we are going to have a huge increase in the amount of food that's consumed on the planet. And also coupled with that, and this is to me is the dichotomy, coupled with that, we have less physical land that we're using for farming for all sorts of reasons, many of them not good, but humans have decided that. We're having less water. We're having less people that can do the farming or want to do the farming. So there's this real disconnect that we've got to address somehow over the next 20 or 30 years.
All right, so let's just run through those numbers again. You're saying 35% by 2030 as far as the demand for food, 2 billion additional people by 2050, and then less land, farmers, labourers, and water at the same time. All right, so we throw all of that in a blender. Morris, what do we get out in terms of a potential solution for this?
We get all sorts of things. Firstly, we should absolutely understand that we will have farmers and farming for the foreseeable future, I mean for the next hundreds and hundreds of years. It's a nonsense that everything will come out of a lab and that you and I are going to find some magical shake that we will take twice a day or whatever and that will be it. I don't want to live in that world, Keir. I don't know about you. So farmers will definitely be part of our life, wonderful people doing wonderful things. But even with the best of intention, the agricultural industry has realised over the last 10 years, and I've done a lot of work with farmers over the last 10 years, that they need to take their wonderful skills and to augment them with technology. So they're looking for better yielding crops now. They're looking for alternatives to human labour. As much as they would love to employ them, can't find them. So robots and drones and swarm robots and all kinds of things that make the physical land able to produce more than it did before.
What about, and when you talk technology, does that mean that genetic modification plays a role? Is it necessarily going to play a role?
I think it has to. And for me, the reality is, and I understand when we talk about this, that there's the extreme where we're getting into CRISPR and we're making what some people call Frankenstein crops, things we've never seen before, and that's a whole different argument. But as humans, we have always manipulated our crops. We've got clear evidence from anthropology that forever looking backwards, that humans understood that a crop that worked particularly well this year in these conditions were the seeds they wanted to plant next year. And they always took the best seeds and moved them forwards, and they always cultivated two of those seeds together over a number of years. So humans have always manipulated. And in fact, I doubt we have the pure crop that we all think of growing on this planet anywhere, except maybe in some rarefied atmosphere. So we will continue to do that, take the best of what we know and move it forward. Do we want genetically modified crops to the point of Frankenstein? Look, sometimes I think we do because of what we demand from our farmers and we demand we want to eat. But at some point, humans have to decide this is enough.
Okay, so the other technological elements that exist that could potentially increase those yields, Morris, you talk about the fact that, you know, robots or automation could kind of play a role. What about just alternate food sources. I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, people have talked about we're going to have to eat insects eventually, but, you know, that there are other sources of protein out there that are much more efficient in far as their yield is concerned and much less deleterious in terms of their effect on the actual planet as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've been eating insects forever again. I mean, our indigenous people have always had it as part of their diet. When you go into Asia, again, always part of the diet. It's the Westerners that think it's a particularly strange thing to do. I had a similar conversation last week on air into Asia, and they could not understand why we were so against eating these insects. So as part of our diet, I think we'll actually see it increasingly in our supermarkets, strangely enough, and it's already there in some supermarkets, not in the form of crickets and cockroaches and things as bugs that we see, but you can now buy flour made from crickets, and that's readily available. You can buy crickets made from, flour made from other insects as well. And you can also buy frozen insects in some supermarkets. Now, again, I know most listeners are saying, yuck, not, you know, I'd rather starve than do that. That's perfectly normal reaction. But we will increasingly turn to these because they are high in protein, high in carbohydrates, things that we need, and readily available and easily farmed.
Incredibly easily farmed. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed trying to stop them from breeding, essentially, Morris.
And that's it. In fact, we could actually do that, you know, two birds with one stone thing, that we have a lot of issues with insects, but if we were to eat them, in fact, we would do ourselves a service and we would do the planet a service as well. So let's decide as a culture over the next decade or so whether we want to move to that. But the flour is something that if listeners begin to pay attention to, they will find is starting to be used in some of the high-end restaurants already.
Yeah, look, I'm looking forward to the day where I can, because I want to do it now, I want to go and make a cricket cake for my kids and then just watch their faces when we tell them it was made of a cricket. Morris Mislowski with us, our business futurist this morning. You did talk about the fact that the idea of, you know, eating things out of petri dishes, you know, shakes, pills, that sort of stuff doesn't really appeal. But is there some validity to what they've been talking about when it comes to literally growing food, growing that protein, like the beef, the chicken, you know, lab-based meat patties, for example, Boris? Is that a pipe dream or is it something that is genuine?
No, it's an absolute reality, and there are lots of companies around it already doing it. There's companies called Impossible Foods, Beyond Meats, Memphis Meats, New Wave Foods, and there's a lot of venture capital money going into it. What these companies have done in various different ways is to take a few stem cells from perhaps the beef or the chicken, but beef is where they all started, literally a handful, 10, 12 stem cells, and they've been able to turn that into thousands of kilos of what we might call hamburger or meat. Now, this started off over the last 10 years or so. About 4 years ago, we saw the first incarnation of a hamburger that cost about $275,000 US to make. Now, you and I would say that's the most expensive hamburger, not likely to have it, but it was its prototype. And they've got that cost down to about $20 now, with a window they believe that within 5 years, they'll have it down to a price where they can commercially put it into a supermarket. And I'm told from all the people that have tasted it, and I do know some that have tasted as well as read a lot about it, that the mouthfeel, the way it feels in the mouth, the taste of it, is very, very similar to what we might expect in a hamburger or a chicken patty.
Okay, so it's on the way then, Morris.
Absolutely on the way. And we're told by these companies, and we would expect in their press releases, but by others who I trust more, that within 10 years it will not be uncommon in the supermarket to make that choice of this piece of beef was grown in the traditional sense, this piece of beef was grown in the lab, and we will make a choice of either or and do that quite readily.
Now, one other bit of technology that comes to mind, and we've all made jokes about this over the decades, you know, the idea of how about you fax me a pizza? That maybe that's not too far removed from the truth when it comes to the new technology that 3D printing is, in terms of Morris being able to actually print things out of stuff which is edible.
Can do it already. Already been done. So you can buy a chocolate printer and you can buy a pizza printer. Now, that's not you and I, the listener, perhaps, but in a commercial sense, you can do that. So the things that are working particularly well in 3D printing are what are called extrusion foods. They're chocolates. So think of a piping bag. All the ingredients are up in a piping bag and you can pipe it out and make shapes. So we're finding that cakes, chocolates, those sorts of things are absolutely 3D printed at the moment. And if you do a search on those things, you'll find brands you can buy. NASA has already put or is about to put into space a 3D pizza maker. as well for its astronauts, and this won't have all the wonderful toppings, but it will put the dough and tomato and some basic toppings on top as well. So we're almost there with that as well. Will we have them in the home? Most probably 15 years from now, we might have one, but definitely on the horizon.
Can I just finish off, Morris, by asking, historically speaking, and I know you said that this is the biggest burst, the biggest spike that we've had in growth, but there have been other countries that have seen some big population growth, you know, over short periods of time. Have they tackled this issue before? Historically speaking, have there been societies, you know, civilizations, countries that have had to deal with this and managed to do so with a combination of what we're talking about now?
Well, as far as we know, not, because what's happened is over a period of time, it might take 50, 100, 200 years, the civilization seemed to have collapsed or seemed to have moved on for other food sources.
Right.
Remembering that as humans, up until recently, it was difficult logistically to bring food into a regional area long term. So we're kind of over that now. We can store and bring foods in from all over the world and centralize. But all of these things most probably have never happened before in society in a sustained way.
Okay, well, I am going to go and get myself a grub to eat and a piece of cricket cake to have with it. Thanks, Morris.
A pleasure.
Bon appetit. That is Morris Mislowski, our business futurist, one eye on the future and one mouth with us. And as we always say, Future Curious Times is his e-magazine. But any of those terms, Morris Mislowski, eye on the future, any of that, if you put it into your favourite search engine, I guarantee you, Morris will be the top return. 14 minutes to 10.